Welcome to Radio Alchemy, where we fuse the fringe with conventional wisdom. Can you believe that this is the 21st century, that future we dreamed of some 50 years ago? Well, here we are, with war, hunger, poverty, environmental degradation, eradication of animal and insect species, blatant oppression, and the continued concentration of wealth. And yet we sit in the midst of another changing of the guard of the presidential order, and they're saying the same thing, over and over again, the same interchangeable issues. Hot buttons for the overtaxed, and I don't mean just monetarily. Are you finally ready to get outside the box, you lovely, incredible people, and take responsibility as the super people of this superpower? You have the reins in your hands, yet you let this beast cast rack and ruin to your benefit. Well, look around you. What makes you think that you will forever be exempt from its wrath? This is Radio Alchemy, and I'm your host, Evan Ray. Provocative information, provocative interviews, factual elements from commercial news and the fringe research. We want you to join us as we construct this puzzle called life with all the pieces. And it's very apropos that I'm speaking about the box in light of tonight's interview. Now, is it Bob Dobbs or is it J.R. Bob Dobbs, Church of the Subgenius or Canadian radio DJ spoken word artist Bob Dobbs? Well, this matter is going to clear itself up along with the introduction of the Android meme. What is the Android meme? Well, did you like the movie The Matrix? Well, that beckons to what this man is all about, who is that and so much more. He is the author of Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs, put out by Perfect Pitch Editions. Its ISBN number is 0-969-4528-1-0. And this is the beginning of a macro-environmental series where we're going to be talking with people that have information and ideas about what you get up and live in the macro-environmental sense on a day-in, day-out basis. Now, this man doesn't need much more introduction. He's going to tell you all about this as we get into this interview, so I'm just going to pop right into it. This is a talk I had with Bob Dobbs, August 1999.
Oh my God!
That question.
For one, I just want to say, audience, we have a special treat today. We have no other than Mr. Bob Dobbs, and if you don't know who he is, you are going to remember this voice and this mind after this interview and talk is done. Is it true that the subgenius Bob that I see in bookstores, this gentleman, you know, very, very straight-laced looking with a pipe sticking out, and you open up the covers and there's lots of tangential conversations and meanings running through this. Is this based on you?
Yeah, it's based on me. It's not me. The image is not me.
No.
What happened was, as you can read in Flipside magazine, which is an interesting punk magazine's been out since 77. I have a column in there, and I'm laying out the history, the unknown history of the 20th century, and it's called Android Memes and Anachrony. Recently, I had, it's a diary, but it's a diary that has an incident from the 70s, and then an incident from the 20s, and an incident from the 30s, incident from the 80s, and then maybe one from the 50s, and then another one from the 50s. I jump around. It's a discontinuous presentation, because I don't want people to think, to go along a chronology and think, well, I don't want to know that part, I want to get to the end. So they don't know when it begins and starts, so it's a collage of ongoing dates and diary entries. So in a recent Flipside, you'd see a entry from February 2nd, 1978, where I was assigned in my intelligence capacities in Dallas. So I'm in this bar, which I can't remember basically what it was, because it wasn't significant at the time. I usually can remember a lot of things. Mm-hmm. But I'm in this bar, and two young men come up. And we're sitting around, and we're just citizens and talking. And one thing led to another, and I found out that they were interested in Robert Anton Wilson, the Illuminatus trilogy. They had read this. And they were talking about conspiracies and things like that, which was these were college age guys. I found out Doug St. Clair Smith was born in 1953. His friend Philo Drummond, who I don't know if that's his real name or not, I didn't get to know him too well, but he was Doug's friend. These two guys, I'm talking to them, so in 1953, 25 years old. So they're just out of college, of that college culture. There's been a lot of conspiracy and CIA talk in the 75 on with the church committee stuff. It's in the air. It's post-Watergate. So this came up, and they were talking in a humorous way. They were smart-ass college guys, and I don't know if Fowler was, but I know Doug St. Clair Smith was. He becomes later Reverend Stang. That's his public name. Reverend Ivan Stang. So Fowler Drummond still has the same name within the subgenius organization, within the book. So here we are, February 2nd, 78, and I thought, well, these are two Americans, and I was born in Paris, so I have a strange identity. I'm French, but then I had a landed immigrant status in Canada, and I don't want to confirm it, I had a Canadian citizenship maybe, but I could move around the whole planet because of my background. And so I'm sitting there listening to these young kids, so I thought, I'm going to tell them some things. I'm going to speak to them what appeared to them to be very authoritatively, but they would not know whether it was real or not, but the impression would be it was authoritative, and I knew it was authoritative, but they would not be able to believe that they actually were hearing, talking to somebody who knew all this stuff. So I laid it out on them, and they got all hopped up and inspired, and then they left. Then I was there the next night. It might have been a hotel bar or some kind of place where I regularly went while I lived in Dallas. They came back the next night, and they said, could you run that by me again? That stuff that you were saying. And this time they were more ready for it. They noted it. They memorized it. And eventually I showed them a picture of my father, because I was talking about the importance of my father, who was a butler for an oligarchic family. And I think that's one of the reasons they came back, was to say, can you reinforce what you're saying? And I said, yeah, here's a picture of my father, who had died 2 years before on July 5th, 1976. He was born on June 4th, 1882. All right, so he was quite old when he died. So here it is, February 78, not quite 2 years later. And I show him this picture. Now, we talk and blah, 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 and it's no big deal to me. 2 years later, I am with Dr. Beter somewhere in Washington or somewhere, and I see this leaflet somewhere. Maybe someone sent it to somebody and they knew me, but I remember I was with Dr. Beter and I said, Dr. Beter, look at this picture. Now, it was what you were talking about, the bobhead with the pipe. And yeah, the cliche statement of what it looks like is it's Ward Cleaver from right. 50s TV. Now, I didn't grow up in America, so I don't know much about that imagery, but now I do. But back then, I didn't know.
Right.
So I had the picture of this pamphlet, join the Church of the Subgenius mm-hmm. and all this stuff. And I showed it to Dr. Beter, who knew my father. And I said, didn't say a word. I said, who's that look like? And he says, well, looks like your father. I says, yeah. Now read what it says. And it says, you want fuck, slack, peace, everything, join the church of slack, all that kind of
right,
jokey,
right.
crazy stuff. You thought you took drugs, join our church, you get the best drugs you ever had. It's all under a picture of my father. And I go, what the heck is this? And so he said, I don't know what that is. And I think I remember, that's a sidetrack, we'll beat her. But so he puzzled over it, and then I said, well, I got this. It seems to be something, some fringe thing going around. So that was my first contact of my father's image. I mean, I didn't know it was a likeness. It was not my father's.
Right.
But people knew my father. Said, doesn't that look like my father? So over the next year or so, I came across in the college culture with people. They started being more popular. I think Palmer Vrides, a Ripoff Press, found them, and then Mark Mothersbaugh Devo supported it. So Reverend Stang, Ivan Stang, started to get supported in this college underground thing. So more literature came out. And when I then the Book of the Subgenius comes out in 83, and I see that, and then I start reading more extensively the conspiracy angle, and I said, could these be those two kids? I eventually probably remembered that account. Could these be these two kids who heard my stuff? They already were into Robert Anton Wilson, and they took acid or something and mixed it all up, because it's got humor and it's got actual stuff that I said, and just a mixture, a bizarre mixture. So over the 80s, I finally found out more about them as a high profile, and then I realized that it was based on that encounter. And I said, well, these are smart kids.
Yeah.
They realized that, and I can communicate,
yes.
at a certain level. And they realized that they could use the information I gave them, and they made a cartoon out of it, basically. So that goes on and takes a life of its own.
Okay.
But what amazed me when I read the Book of the Subgenius, or maybe even 82 got some more pamphlets, which of my... I always was studying American youth culture in that, because since I was born in 1922, when I came over in the 50s, I was always curious about what was happening after Elvis came in. And as a European, it was sort of strange to us. I mean, an older European like me. So I always was following, and in the 60s, I go into fringe bookstores, the hippie culture, look at stuff. So I was sort of inclined to find this kind of literature.
Right.
But what amazed me when I, in 82, 83, when I saw the book or a pamphlet around time, that the dogma was that the Axis would land on July 5th, 1998. And I go, that's 22 years after my father's death date. And I had mentioned to my father, you know, I said, here's a picture of my father back in, this is 1978, I'm saying to him, he died just a couple years ago, actually July 5th, 1976. So here's this date for, in their dogma, this is 1981, 82, they're saying, we're going to work for Bob, Bob's going to save, is going to be able to intervene, and these monsters Axis are going to come July 5th, 1998, 7 o'clock in the morning, going to eat the whole planet up, and if we're not right with Bob, you are going to get eaten. So you got to join the church and work with Bob. So I said, well, that's 22 years from 76 to 98. I told him all about the meaning of the 22, the Kabbalah, and plus my own little take on it, because I was seeing 22s everywhere. So I thought they took the 20. They said, well, this is the picture. We remember what he looked like. We found a picture that looks like it. And they found it, I think, if I remember, they found it in the South Atlantic Bell telephone book, the picture. It was some kind of weird ad or something. I think I'm right on that. And so they had this picture, and they thought it looked like me, or me, my father, but they were talking about me. But the point was, they couldn't use a picture of me, I could sue them.
Yes.
But they could use a picture as an inside joke of something that looked like my father. But the killer was that it was 22 years after his death date. So they created this dogma that the exes would come 22 years after my father died. So that clued me into the connection to me. And then as time went on in the 80s, I got more evidence that, yes, it was based on what I told them. So I inspired the Church of Subgenius, but I have nothing to do with it. So meanwhile, just to complete this point, because
yes,
you may not have there's two conflicting images of me in the popular culture. In the late 80s, I moved to Toronto from Dallas, 82, 83, 84, basically in 83, 84. After I did a military operation with Dr. Beter on September 17, 1982. In 84, I'm back in Toronto with my wife, and then I decide I'm going to have to start releasing information. So I found a journalist, Bob Marshall, and I got him to start releasing all kinds of controversial College Station news, or it was a College Station, but in Toronto also a community station. So he started doing it, and he did that from 84 to 87. Then I arranged for him to get fired, but it was an inside job. Bob didn't like it at first, but then he understood it was a larger plan that I was working on. So I went on the air on June 17, 1987, after Bob had been fired, and moved in with another guy who liked Bob, but said, I want you on, Bob, once I told him who I was. So I went on, and his name was Mike Dyer, and from that point on, I announced that I was the real Bob Dobbs, that the Church Subgenius was based on, though I had nothing to do with that stuff. I'm not taking away from their own creativity and what they made out of it, which is great entertainment. I've been to their revivals, really funny stuff. But I was it was time for me to say what I was really talking about, or what I could say that inspired them, and it's now to give it to everybody, not just two college kids. So I stayed on the air for 4 years, till August 91, all right? And I led the Toronto audience, and people used to tape it and send the tapes. I led them through the collapse of the Cold War. I predicted in 88, it's on tape, October 16th, 88, in an interview I did in L.A. while I was visiting Zappa, I said what the 90s would be. If you see, I said the Berlin Wall's going down, Germany be reunited, and all this stuff. Now they say in the regular media, nobody predicted this, nobody saw this. Well, there's me and a few, I know one medium, the Evergreens predicted it. I don't know how many other humans predicted it, but I did. And it's on tape, it's on record.
It's on tape.
Yeah. So I led them all through this, and so the audience was amazed, because I was releasing information that no one who knew, but I had a good mind on communicating. I could do it humorously, I could do it interestingly with interesting metaphors, and also the information was getting confirmed as it was unfolding. So there was a student of Marshall McLuhan. Have you ever heard of Marshall McLuhan? The
yes,
famous media guru who, in quotes, media guru, who created the phrase, the medium is a message, and the world's a global village. He did a lot more than that, but that's just like a public filter point that the average citizen might have heard about. But he was a great scholar and a great translator of Joyce's Finding His Way. That's Marshall McLuhan. So one of his students had been listening to Bob Marshall, unbeknownst to me, through Toronto in the 80s. Then he continued listening to me. And he recognized my McLuhan knowledge, because I knew McLuhan and you would use some of it. So unbeknownst to me, he got it in 91 when I went off the air and disappeared. Actually came to New York and L.A. to do this American operation. He got a really good synthesizer computer guy, took the Bob Dobbs tapes he taped of my show, put them together with this guy, and released an album on April 22nd, 1992. Now, he had no problems with contract or copyright, because I had said, this information is free, I'm a very wealthy person, I don't need this stuff, I don't need me reimbursed, do whatever you want with it. Turned out one guy did it. So Nelson Thal releases the album April 22nd, 1992.
What's it called? It's
called Bob's Mediacology.
Wow.
So what happened was that some Americans got the CD, and they thought it was connected to, it was the Bob Dobbs of the Church of Subgenius. So they put out ads with the Bob head, you know, with the image that Reverend Stang had created. So when Stang got wind of that, he started threatening to sue. Now, I didn't know this was going on, but he wanted to sue Nelson Thal because they're linking in and with them. But Nelson Thal always, he didn't really know much about that church. He was a Canadian. He just was doing with what he knew about Bob Dobbs. So he told Stang, you know, buzz off. We're in Canada. You can't get to us anyways, and we don't mean that. And he said to Stang, is there anything on the album that Bob says is similar to what you say? And Stang, found out later when I met Nelson, that he said, no, there isn't. But they're using the imagery. Well, I don't think Nelson had any control over the image use in the ads done by other people in the zine culture who hear about it and put their own interpretation on it. So that became a big issue where Stang started bad-mouthing the albums. But, of course, that was great for Nelson because it created notoriety.
Yes.
So what you had is the 92, 93, 94 unfolded. You had many people completely confused. And I mean, Reverend Stang had people, when they get the Bob's Mediacology album, thinking it was Stang's guy. They didn't like the album. It wasn't. It was like more serious or something and not as raw edge that they got from Stang. So they complained to Stang. So Stang got embarrassed. And so all this consumer confusion.
Yes.
There was, on the album, there was the Subgenius anthem, The X's Have Landed, but now Dave Neufeld bought that from a former Subgenius who sold it. So they had the right to use it. But it did, that I was aware of the Church of Subgenius when I was doing my stuff and would play off that. But I never claimed that I created, that I was part of it and that I wrote those books. I just said I inspired it. But that would come up occasionally.
Yes.
Nelson didn't know that much about that, but David did, so that's why that song was put in there. So yes, people could think it was me. I mean, think it was Stang's guy. And Nelson it was a serendipitous thing. Oh, you mean this is Bob stuff and this is what they could do? Well, good, we need the notoriety. So what happened is that basically Stang would, whenever he got a chance to, in some media outlet, he would knock the albums and accuse me of ripping them off, even though I had nothing to do with the albums, didn't make it, even though it's my content. But I had,
and even though you inspired it from the very
beginning. And I inspired it, but I don't know what he makes of that, if he remembers it or something, because I haven't talked to him since then. I don't know anything about him in that sense.
Right.
I don't know what. They may have taken so much acid, and maybe they were talking to so many other people that they lost the source of the picture or something. So I don't know what kind of confusion they come out of. When I say acid, I mean staying cell. I mean, I don't know if he took acid, but I understand that culture took drugs and all this stuff. And,
yes.
And maybe Stang brags about it, but he uses it in code. But the thing is they were normal college adult 70s kids, right?
Yeah.
Going up to their 30s and getting that crisis when the 30-year-olds and getting mad because at that point the economy collapsed and they weren't getting any money and they hallucinate. So so here's this stupid thing, these two media images going around in 92, 93, 94, one from Canada. So that eventually they made a distinction. That's the Canadian Bob Dobbs and there's the Dallas Bob Dobbs. Meanwhile, in the middle of this, I wanted to leave a memento to my Toronto audience, so I put together a book called Fatic Communion with Bob Dobbs. And that's my production. That's me. So I always say, it says in the program, if you want to know Bob Dobbs, see, the staying Bob Dobbs is called J.R. Bob, in quotes, Dobbs. J.R. Bob Dobbs. I'm not J.R. Bob. I'm Bob Robert Dobbs.
Right.
You know, but it's Bob Dobbs, we're used to saying.
Right.
And my family goes back centuries, and it's even referred to in a Charles Dickens journalistic article around 1853, 1854. I don't have the date right handy, but it's in the collection of his miscellaneous journalistic articles, where he writes an article on the toady tree. That's the title. And he goes through all these different people that Dickens knows in London and what they are like and how they all are sort of hypnotized by authority and are toadies. You know what a toady is? A suck up to something, right? So one of them is a guy named Dobbs, and he describes Dobbs as someone who always seems to know 6 weeks ahead of everybody else what's going to happen in the parliament, in politics in London and on the world level. And he also, Dickens describes as whenever you see him in the halls of Westminster Abbey, he's always talking to the most influential cabinet ministers, even though he's like a nondescript character or something, or you know, not a lord. So, but Dickens satirizes that Dobbs as a guy sucking up to power. But he was puzzled by how come Dobbs knew inside stuff all the time, if you care to find out what that Dobbs knew, and Dickens would and interacted. So here is this great grandfather. Hooked into the Dickens world. And the reason my great-grandfather knew all this stuff is because he was a butler to the oligarchy, involved in intelligence, and his father was involved in intelligence, goes back to 300 years. And that's what I was born into. So Dickens was describing exactly what it was, and he, being more of a lefty kind of a guy, Dickens, he didn't like these kind of people. So he made fun of my great-grandfather in the thing. So, but there's a historical reference to the Dobbs family, and it's very accurate. Dobbs would know what was going on because he was part of the conspiring power structures.
It's like you were moralized in so many different ways.
Yeah, dear. I was moralized?
Immoralized.
Who, me?
No, the Dobbs. Oh, the Dobbs family.
No, you mean immortalized?
Immortalized.
Yeah. So actually, we could say there's three versions of me. We got the Dickens version from 140 years ago.
Yes.
Then you have the 80s version with Stang, and the 90s version with Nelson Thal.
And talking about...
So, I've asked you, am I connected to that? It's been fully explained, right?
Yes.
I'm not connected to that, though I did inspire it, and...
You were the spark.
I was a spark, I think. It seems that way. They got the 22 years. They've got the right date.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And talking about your background, could you, please? I mean, tell us.
Yeah.
Tell us.
Well, I was born in, and this is all being laid out in Flipside magazine. And the point is that I had, Flipside found out about me in 1995. I was on the LA radio in 93-94, and some kid, some guy, young guy who worked for Flipside or had something to do with Flipside, who used to hear my radio shows.
Yeah.
So he eventually got in touch with my agent down there, Jerry Fialka.
Yeah.
I was living in New York. I used to do the show from New York.
Yeah.
And he called him up. Hey. do you want to stop tape?
Well, okay.
So in 93-94, I was on the LA radio, and people were listening, and Arthur from Flipside magazine would be listening to me, or he was associated with Flipside in the next couple of years. He eventually got in touch with Jerry Fialka in 95 and said, I remember Bob Dobbs, we don't hear him anymore on the LA radio, but I'd like to see if he would write for Flipside. So he got in touch with Jerry, and Jerry then put him on to me, or told me, so I called him and said, sure, we've got some stuff. So we started submitting articles, interviews with me that Jerry'd done, other people, and that went from July 95 up to the early 98. Yeah, and in January 98, Arthur told me, I mentioned to him in a conversation as we were discussing the next article, I said, you know, I've been on every cover of Flipside since the summer of 95. You know, they always have different bands each issue, but every issue, Bob Dobbs. Yeah. You know, a zine doesn't have the same people in every issue. So I said, it's sort of funny. I've been a main attraction on the cover. And he goes, yeah, I hadn't thought of that. I'm going to have to talk to the editor about that. So a couple days later, I get back to him, and he says, we talked. And I said, yeah, that ain't right. You shouldn't be on every issue in a way. This isn't appropriate in some weird way. I thought it was appropriate, but I was pointing out that, you know, do you know that it could look weird? So they said, well, what we decided to do is we're not going to have you on the cover anymore. We're going to give you a column. So I said, great. And so he said, come up with a name. So I come up with a name, Android Memes Xenocrony. And so the column starts in March, and then it's every 2 months, and then there's the May issue. Those two issues had old interview dialogues with a guy named Randy Copang, me and him. And because of the technical situation, a lot of those articles from July 95 to May 98 are when it was come in by email or whatever, processed into Arthur's computer, there'd be a lot of mistakes. He tried to clean it up, but it wasn't perfect. It was quite garbled, not perfectly every word corrected. So I said, okay, now we've done May 98, upcoming is July 98. July 5th, 1998 is what? The day the X has come.
Yes.
Okay? And so I said, good, I'm gonna have complete control of the column from July on, because I'm going to submit my diary entries, and I'm going to make sure that everything's spelled right and the grammar's right and the punctuation and whatever, it's clear, and I'll email it directly into Arthur, and Arthur can put it in the computer, and there'll be no mistakes. So finally, I had control over the printing of it. So in the July issue, I begin the diary entries, and I begin the diary entry with the January 22nd, 98 conversation where Arthur is saying, hey, you know, I point out, I'm on the cover, what are we going to do, blah, blah, blah. So that's how the diary begins, because that's why I became a column. So that's the first explanation in the first diary entry. So so what was interesting is I always claim, once I knew more about Stang's ideology, that the X's weren't going to swallow the earth in July 5th, 98. If the X's were going to do anything, they'd already done it, and they'd connected with me in 1988 in February, and I was able to knock off the, take control of the Illuminati Secret Council 10 that I was part of. And the X's helped me do that. So Stang was 10 years off, and they didn't need anybody, they just helped me. So I actually acted out his prophecy that Bob Dobbs would somehow save us from the X's. But in
10 years earlier.
But that was 10 years later. It turned out, yeah, 10 years earlier, what actually happened, the X's didn't eat the world. They helped me knock off Prince Charles, Romanov, Gorbachev's guy, and Prince Durantaxis. So by March 88, I had control of the whole solar government. Now, I'm talking about this on the radio. Of course, nobody believes it, but that's the best cover you can have. You hide right out in the open.
Yes.
As I was with at lunch with Leonard, what's his last name?
Horowitz.
Yeah.
Oh, please.
He knew he was putting out controversial information, and he was telling them and me that he learned very early. I think Scott asked the question, Scott sitting over there, wasn't he paranoid? He said, well, I understood that if you stayed in the media, in the spotlight, stayed out there, you were safer.
Yes.
So he understands that, and I knew that, of course. So I was in the media, and you hide. I'm half conspiracy. I'm safe, but I'm also a conspiracy because I'm hiding what's really going on about what I'm doing,
yes.
But I'm safe by being in the media. So it's a little more complex in my situation.
Yes.
Actually, Leonard is hiding from me.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm who I say I am, not that I'm going to kill him, but he's hiding from my associates.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
I'm hiding from my associates on a certain level,
yes.
But I'm also, I can continue doing stuff in the media and saying these amazing things, and no, the average citizen won't believe it, but they find it greatly entertaining. And when you're laughing, you're learning. So I'm MK-altering whether they know or not, because they're laughing so much about the improbability of it that all this really interesting information is going in their minds. All right?
Absolutely.
Real information.
Yeah.
So I start, so it was very symbolic for me, and Xenocrony helped me. It turned out one thing after another. We didn't know in July 98 that would happen in January, you know, when we first, but here it was, it turned out, July 98, the month that the Church of the Subgenius would kaput, because they were all waiting for the Axis, and when July 5th passed, of course, the Axis never came. It was they held the big convention up in upstate New York, and that was the end of the Church. Though they've done a lot of double-taking and said,
yeah.
Maybe we had the time wrong. It'll be new. So, and that was all humorous. So they tried to keep it going, even though it was all over.
Yes.
So it's appropriate that the real Bob Dobbs shows up in the July 98 issue and is in every issue, which is every 2 months, and I'm laying out the real history, which is what I originally wanted to get out. So what was the question now? So that's what's happening now. So what am I revealing? Well, my life. The fact that I was born in 1922, February 2nd, the day James Joyce put out Ulysses, or received his first copy from Sylvia Beach at Shakespeare and Company, the copy of Ulysses. And then it started to circulate the next few months, but that was Joyce's birthday, February 2nd, 1922. I was born that day, and that was the day he got Ulysses, the first copy. He then did Finnegan's Wake for the next 17 years, and he got his copy of that on February 2nd, 1939. Now, my father, I'm in Paris, Joyce is in Paris. By the time I'm 14, which is 1936, my father starts exposing me to people he knows. And so I met, in 1936, 1935, I met James Joyce. that's featured in the first July issue, my first interaction. I met Wyndham Lewis, I met T.S. Eliot, I met Gurdjieff, I met Aleister Crowley, all these different...
Aleister Crowley.
Yeah. And I met Adolf Hitler in October 36 in Munich.
Yeah.
Because the Olympics was a big deal and lots of attention on Hitler that year, and my father had to go there to represent his people in relation to this new monster that was surfacing.
Wow.
So I was a little kid sitting in the side of the office seeing this guy talk to my father. And, you know, as a young guy, it was quite cold to me. I knew of him, but we didn't know what was going to happen. My father probably knew, but I didn't. So people say, well, what was Hitler like? I say, well, it was quite intimidating, the coldness of the room when we're in there. It was like, ooh. But he was an interesting, charismatic talker. And so in recent Flipside, you'll see the diary entry, the exchange of what he said to my father. He sent us down to the basement where he had a movie theater. That's how I end that entry. I don't have everything from each entry
right.
in there.
Right.
But the main point is they talk. My father makes an agreement with them. And so then he says, okay, I got to go do something. You go down to the movie theater and we'll watch a movie. So I end the entry by us going down to the theater. So I saw a movie with Hitler. He came down about halfway through it. I mean, we were waiting, and then the projector said, well, I don't know if he's going to come, so we put it on, and it was he had a love affair with Greta Garbo, I think. No, Marlene Dietrich. He was obsessed with her.
Yes.
And so we watched the Marlene Dietrich movie. You know the story about her. He wanted to marry her, offered her all the power that he thought he was going to acquire, and she told him to go, you know, screw off. And
I'm a star.
So she's sort of famous for doing that,
which
was a risk because he might have killed her, you know,
yes.
for that.
Yes.
So we watched the Marlene Dietrich movie. I don't know what it was. But the... And I didn't know that about Hitler at the time, you know,
right.
about his emotional identification with Marlene.
Yes.
So anyways, I started meeting all these people. My father was, I didn't know it, but he had an agenda. And World War II broke out, and went through that, late 40s. In 44 I met Connie at that time.
Who's your wife today?
Yeah,
yes.
And she was from an oligarchic family.
Yes.
I live in oligarchic situations, grow up in it, but I'm of the Butler family, you know. And we live comfortably, but we're not the oligarchs, but we're part of the network.
Yes.
Because what happened after World War I, the oligarchs didn't have as much power. That really wiped out that 19th century power structure, and technology was changing, and radio was making things more democratic, information overload. Control of money was a puny little semi-medium compared to newer medium, which I think I explained in my lecture yesterday.
Yes.
So by 19... Into the 20s and 30s, the committee people, Secret Council 10 people, brought my father in.
Yeah. You know what?
You want to stop?
Yeah, let's hold that, and we're going to go to show number two. One second. This is KPFK, 90.7 FM, and this is Radio Alchemy. You're listening to an interview with Bob Dobbs that I did last August, 1999. As you know, he is speaking about his life as a member of the intelligence community at some of the highest levels. And, you know, while you're laughing, you're learning. And please stay tuned for the second half of this interview, and we will be right back with that.
Connie, his name was Constant. French family, and she's got this American name. She was a strange person. I met when we were was in a club, and I was sort of curious about the Nazi people that she and her parents were hanging around with. And this was during the Vichy government in France, when the occupied France and the collaborative government was down South France in Vichy. So I In 44, I'm 22. I know a little more since I was 14. My father showed me the ropes, and I came home one night and I said, why, you know, I saw a very interesting woman there, you know, someone my age, young woman, and I noticed that her and her parents were with all these Nazi generals. Well, why would that be? And he said, well, I know this family, and I'll look into that. And so the next thing, to jump ahead, I'm on a Jeep going down into the Battle of the Bulge area in November, December 44 with Connie. Well, Connie, me, Constance.
Yes.
And I was with Fritz Kramer, who's a whole story in itself. If you read Peter Drucker's book, The Man Who Invented Henry Kissinger, that's yes. Fritz Kramer. So these things are explained more in the flip side, the diary entry. So I'm just jumping through. So the World War II ends. I'm aware of the complicity of Project Paperclip and all that stuff because I'm seeing it happen through my father. And then as the 40s unwind...
What is Project Paperclip?
That's what somebody, Leonard, mentioned today, the bringing the Nazi scientists over to do NASA, start the space program in the late 40s, early 50s.
Okay.
It also it leads into bringing over Nazi psychiatrists, and they get involved with MKUltra. All of what is considered evil about American CIA activities was supplemented because they brought over a lot of Nazi scientists, like Wernher von Braun, the guy who ran the space program. He worked in concentration camps and the mines and things around Hitler's corrupt regime. So that was a big scandal that was kept away from the Americans till the 70s.
Yes.
So, but the Russians also took on Nazi scientists, so it was a matter of who was going to get them. So, but these, you learn when you're in that level of power how complex it all is. It's almost like, you know, there's no human choice. They're going to do that, we got to do it. You know, we're going to bomb them, okay, they'll bomb us. It's just inhuman. But the machines that are making it inhuman are extensions of us and are therefore human. So let's remember that.
Well, we're going to get to
that.
We
made them. Yeah. So it's basically, my father brought me in to the intelligence activities because he'd gotten the confidence of the Secret Council of 10, and it was even a stranger situation after World War II. So he saw. I would not have said this 10, 15, 20 years ago, but he saw that. He wanted to infiltrate me into it. So I'd be the first normal person, a normal bloodline, to be involved and become like a mini James Bond, though that's a little dramatic, but a gopher for all this stuff. Because my father was getting older and he wasn't going to do it, but he was going to have me substitute.
Yeah.
So he had an in. But he had an agenda to get me out, to know what was going on, and then figure out how to get the family out of this situation. So in an upcoming flip side, I will feature... a series of conversations over 42 to 64 with my father Rene, where you will see in retrospect how he exposed me to what was really going on. So I did intelligence work on the highest levels of the solar government, not the world government, and that was the information structure being built through satellites in the after Sputnik in 57, and Connie was part of it. So that's from 57 on through the 60s. So all the major, I was assigned to the American wing because I was assigned to Iran to deal with Mossadegh. And the Shah of Iran wanted to get back his royalty and control of Iran. And certain international capitalist interests wanted him in. They didn't like the leftist guy, Mossadegh. So you'll see it in recent flip side. I assured Mossadegh, based on what I know, that he was not going to be kicked out. Well, in the early 50s, he got kicked out. And so I screwed up there. And then in 53, 54, when the coup happens in Guatemala, I had been telling the guy, our Benz, that he was not going to, that our people were supporting him. Well, there was a lot of factional fighting in the Secret Council 10 that I wasn't aware of, you know what I mean? And I was set up and duped.
Yes.
So I was exiled to North America, given a desk job in North America, so to speak. You
right,
know,
right.
But it wasn't a desk job. But the point is, I was taken out of the major operation. I had failed as an up-and-coming thing.
Yes.
But as Xenocrony happens, I was assigned to the American zone, which was exactly where life was going to start taking off. And this is in 54.
Right.
We still had a center... a focus on Europe from 46 to 56 because still America's going through McCarthyism, still looks like a hick country that can't understand the post-World War II realities, and Europe was a real hip place in culture and politics.
Yes.
The Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau, Jackie Onassis, they all went to Paris in late 40s, early 50s.
Yes.
So being sent into America in 54 was like a demotion. Well, things turned around after McCarthyism went, and America blossomed. Right. And
you were the point man.
And I was the point man. And I feature, it's very interesting, I feature in some of my diary entries from the 50s how I'm going out with my friend Garrett Dean in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. Talk about a fringe place. going around there and studying Elvis, and I'm all intrigued by this. And in retrospect, it's very interesting what I got involved in. You know, it all was useful because nobody knew that software, culture, pop culture would take over the world. They didn't know that in the 50s. So I was right in the position. So then, in brief, I then realized my father's agenda and the good luck that I was in North America. Because now I've been put into the avant-garde situation. So I started going around and searching for information that the Secret Council 10 ignored or whatever. So I met all kinds of interesting people like Mae Brussel, Frank Zappa, Dave Worster, a media bump in Seattle. Let's see, Herbert W. Armstrong on the Wildwood Church of God. He was an interest. He was the best of the fundamentalists, so I enjoyed interacting with that kind of mindset.
Yes.
And Garrett Dean in Nova Scotia was a great New York actor, but he had sort of semi-retired in Nova Scotia by the 60s. And then I met Dr. Beter. So I began accidentally fulfilling my father's agenda beyond what he imagined. So,
if you had a what is it, job description, what necessarily
right.
would
okay.
it be?
What I did was, since the solar government didn't sit on the sidelines, and they represented royal, oligarchic gold and banknotes and credit going back 400 years, so they had the solid foundation of wealth.
Yes.
But what happened after World War I, after the boom of the 20s when the economy collapsed in 1929? The owners gave up and turned the system over to the managers because money was obsolete and became a public property. So you brought in the welfare state.
That's so weird to hear money being obsolete.
Yeah, public property. Now, what, you know why that is?
Why is that?
Because money as a measure of wealth could not keep up in the 20s with the wealth that was registering through music, culture, and all the roaring 20s. The cars, these were. It was a general state of communism in terms of the average peasant having all these artifacts.
Yes.
So once you had them, it was wealth beyond accounting. Okay, you're going to have 3 grains of cereal a day. You can have one newspaper back in the 19th century. The wealth. Now, Marshall McLuhan figured this out. And so I interacted with him a lot in the 50s. I was assigned to spy on him because he was exposing this truth. The solar government knew this.
Yes.
So the gold guy, the authority of the banker having money power is obsolete by 1930. Because when you start guaranteeing welfare, unemployment insurance, and basic stuff, which was technologically necessary because the people couldn't go back to the countryside and grow little things. The countryside was being bought up by corporations and governments. So they were inside a womb that they needed the poor man's credit card, which was money.
Yes.
So it became a guaranteed environment.
Yes.
So it's public property. But still, wealth making and a sense of control of the community and knowledge and what time it is, it still goes on. And that's the solar government's role. We were not involved in the money world from 1930 to 1980. We had the wealth, and we didn't have to work, or the people I worked for,
right.
But we had to know what new technologies were coming in,
right.
What new effects on the populations, and what changes are happening, because they may get wise to the real history and the power we had behind the scenes historically,
yes.
And revolution or war breaks out.
Yes.
So we were just surveillers, spies, monitors. We were the shepherds watching the post-World War II world unveil.
And that's what put you in the
top
prime
the
seat.
Yeah, where I knew about technology things way before corporations did. And you will, if you read my flip side things, you'll see me going on interacting with what later become famous people, famous spies. I worked with Alan Dulles. I was like they knew their relationship to what we were.
Yes.
But they could have a superiority complex because they were the movers and shakers under the post-money world. We were just like a leftover medium of wealth that unfortunately had no more relevance, it seemed, from 1930 to 1980.
Yeah.
So, but still, they knew we had incredible power. If something happened and that whole structure, that collective state socialism and corporate socialism collapsed, we're the only ones who had wealth that was not based on loans but on investment. See, the government from 1930 on lent out stuff, which became the Achilles heel. Because when the countries in the debt crisis of the 70s couldn't pay back, it all collapsed.
Yes.
So the only people who could prop up the money medium were ones who had money that was solidly based, not on loans, but on investments, and still had solid money. That's who we were. But in the 40s and 50s, 60s, Alan Dulles and them are running around hoping they can bypass that, but they still got to deal with us. So I'm the guy who,
Who would I be? I could be like Al Gore, representing the White House. I go around, I give the party line. You're the Department of Agriculture. Well, the president feels this, and we're going to do that, and you've got to remember that. This is what I did on a very secret level. I interact with mafia people and all this. Yeah. So, of course, I knew about the Kennedy assassination. I understood what was happening up to a point, but I certainly knew all about it beforehand, and I knew all the stuff that happened after.
Now, was it true Kennedy was killed because he wanted to change the economy? He wanted to change the Federal Reserve System?
Okay, now here's where you're thinking one reason. Yeah. If you look at my chart, we have a multi-environmental world. Right. I represented the money medium, an ancient technology going back to the printing press.
Yes.
Then you have steel power, you have oil power, you have Hollywood power, right. You have literacy power, you have Con Ed power. You've got to see these are industrial environments.
Yes.
So, when an event happens, it affects every one of those environments differently. It's an ecology.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And all these structures are interpenetrating. And when something happens in the agriculture industry, that affects investments, it affects Hollywood, and then the people are changing and coming up with crazy notions and fads. So why was Kennedy killed? You asked, why was Kennedy killed?
Yes.
Kennedy was killed for about 25 reasons,
25.
Because you have 25 environments who are a bit pissed off.
Yes.
But the at what was happening from 61 to 63, and what was happening on the broadest Esperanto level, Camelot, this guy Kennedy had a powerful impact on people all around the world that was beyond the Alan Dulleses or the corporate executives who ran the multinational corporations, and America was just a little division, a department in the global theater. But that Department of America had created a charismatic image thanks to television that went all over the place. Now, not everybody understands the effect of television. We in the Secret Council 10 did. It was our job. But generally, managers in CIA, the KGB, all these different things, they're just half-informed people. They're worried about power. They say, this guy's getting power beyond what we want. You know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
And they're also confused by the TV effect.
Yes.
So in general, on the broadest level, Kennedy had to be killed because his image was too strong in the TV medium.
But what are
okay, so that's one simple.
Right, right.
Now, other people. Now, I'm not going to get into who killed Kennedy because you will be wiped out.
Sure.
You know what I mean? This is the most dangerous topic.
Yes.
It's hardly relevant to what's going on in 1999.
Sure.
But on the level of information, which we're seeing at this conference, people don't have a sense of history.
Right.
And they want to see how the domino dice fell.
Yes.
If they actually knew what happened then, a lot of mysteries of information confusion would be cleared up from 63 to 99, right?
Yeah.
But that is a long time ago. That's
right.
10,000 years ago in
right.
terms of what's going on.
True.
So it's no point bringing up these issues to get
right.
us all in trouble.
Okay, great.
And you know, I'm relatively safe, but I don't know what mania. If I told what was going on, there's a citizen out there who will get mad. You know what I mean?
Very true.
If he could find me.
Yes.
And
right.
any media person who publishes it on any big level, if you're on a little station, it's not a big deal.
Right.
But if it snowballed into something and other people could understand it, and Peter Dale Scott came in, respectable researchers, and they said, you got it. We're going to feature Brenda. We're going to have an expose on PBS.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You get to about PBS level. Then the people who were involved get serious. They say, wait a minute. We've got to make those phone calls. Pleasant threats. If they don't follow, then we make those bullets. You know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So we don't need to go into, but I'm trying to, the more important thing, because
right.
the mass effect of media from television on, which is really the issue of the last 30 years.
Yes.
It's what everybody, including the richest people in the world, their children are taking drugs and they can't stop it because they're all wired up by the effect of computers and the cathode ray tube and all that's happened since television. These are such awesome bombs, bigger than the hydrogen bomb, that is a more important issue of what we're trying to deal with, if we can even deal with it.
Yes.
So that's why I'm emphasizing the Kennedy assassination example of the effect of television threatening the old 19th century and early 20th century power structure.
Very good. Is it true that these power structures, the solar government, don't they pick and choose who goes into the controls? Don't they have an influence on who goes in the controls of the different governments, like you're saying, in Iran and also...
Right.
In
as we got into after 57, as a real wealth that came out of the military exploitation of the space program, transistor radio and all this stuff.
Right.
You have so many, you have Elvis's guy, Colonel Parker.
Mm.
He's threatened by Motown. You know what I mean? Then the Beatles come.
Mm.
You see there's so many identity threats and power structures that you start to have conspiracy among the people, among their own little industries that they're involved in.
And music,
yeah. And so people are so involved fighting,
right.
and your question was, is the solar government controlling the appointments?
Yes.
Well, they didn't have to anymore. That's why it was. This is the concept I gave Philo Drummond and slang, Reverend Singh, yeah, or Doug St. Clair Smith, is, yeah, the idea of the slack of those on the level of solar government. We don't have to do anything.
Right.
We just have to make sure everything keeps going.
Yeah.
And because we know that LBJ is going to make sure Nixon's not president,
yes,
and there's all those conspiracies within that.
Yes.
And they have pecking order in their own little mafias and secret societies that organize who gets appointments.
Right.
So that is important for people underneath the White House. The average citizen, if he wants to become Secretary of Agriculture, he's going to have to go through those secret societies.
Yes.
The people I represent at the top and the most hidden Big Brother level,
yes,
are not worried about that level.
Okay.
They are worried about the level that is on their level.
Yes.
And that's what you'll see in Flipside, who I interact with.
Yes.
I mean, so we actually control in our little area.
Right.
And in the multi-environments, the solar government is just another little area.
Right.
But in terms of certain historical factors, we're a very powerful area.
Yes.
But not in relation to the music industry or Hollywood. We have nothing to do with that. You know what I mean?
Right.
Look at JFK Jr. Yeah. I don't know what movie it was, but they did a satire 10 years ago. I remember this movie. And it was a JFK Jr. Character who comes to Hollywood, and he's leafing through all the pictures and bios of the starlets,
yes,
and the directors and the movie makers are trying to organize a movie script. I think it was a sort of a comedy, but a serious comedy. But this JFK Jr. character is bugging him because he's saying, "Where can I get in touch with this starlet?" Now, what you have there, the Kennedy were a powerful family.
Yes.
They had investments in Hollywood, perhaps. I'm not sure. But the point is that JFK Jr. could walk around Hollywood as if he owned the place. But he had nothing to do with the making of the movies.
True.
But he could come in and have access to the bios and see who he's going to have a date with, right? See what I'm saying?
Yes.
So you see how it's a side issue, his power he has, mm-hmm, developed by historical media.
Mm-hmm.
But he does get to meet a Daryl Hannah and run around with all these people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example of, in the American context, of the people that I live with. Most of the people that I worked with in the oligarchy, you never heard of these families. They go back too far.
Yeah.
The popular image is the Rothschilds. And in America, the Rockefeller. These are Johnny-come-latelys. Rockefeller was a ditch digger in 1850, 1860, when the people, as a butler family, we were involved with families that went back 200 years.
Yes.
So I won't go into a sidetrack. Okay, that's the end of that.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, we got,
yeah.
Okay, end of that topic. What's the next?
Well, I'm tempted. I think we have around maybe 4 or 5 more minutes left within this program.
Right.
And so I'm not sure I want to launch into the Android meme.
No,
at
next
this
show.
Point. Yeah, next show.
So if you want to take,
yes,
up what we've talked about, some,
yes,
auxiliary questions.
Yes. Oh, geez. Gosh, we've been to so many places. Let me recap.
You want to stop the tape?
Yeah, yeah.
Stop.
My next question is, does the solar government answer to anybody? Do they have any besides?
They never did. They never had to. But as we got into the 70s and reality disappeared, they had to answer to the fact that machines were coming alive.
Yes.
And that leads into the Android meme,
yes,
which would be a topic we do in the next show.
Okay.
But the fact that the technology came alive and started to simulate the Illuminati,
right,
that threatened the Illuminati.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, they finally met their maker, so to speak, you know?
You mentioned that there was a crisis within the Illuminati up until 1980.
From 30 to 80,
right.
This is a good point to end on. From 30 to 80, the government bureau, the liaison between the business and government took over the Western world. And it was a reverse image, but the same thing in Russia.
Yes.
It was state with the business underneath that. But it was a corporate and state socialism or a huge environment. With money as a public property. The way in Russia money was a public property is that you didn't have any money, but you were guaranteed jobs and everything. You know what I mean?
Right,
you didn't need a little ticket, but you got in. But in America, because it's based on individualism, you had to have a ticket to rotate and spiral into other levels, but they always gave you a floor of tickets if you lost your ticket, right?
Right,
you know what I mean?
Right, yes,
so,
very true.
So from 1930 to 1980, that structure happened.
Yeah.
But as the machine came alive in the 70s and even that socialist collective, and I don't mean socialism and the capitalist, that structure collapsed. It had an identity crisis as an environment within this, the fact that machines coming alive, and that's what we call the computer speed up, living at the speed of light. You couldn't measure anything. So they also had sent out loans all over the place in the third world countries after the oil crisis, couldn't pay it back. So they went bankrupt, and Paul Volcker in 79 starts raising the interest rates up to 20%. So you had that weird period from 79 to 82 where the government, this government structure, government business situation, state capitalism situation is floundering and dying and disappearing. So it all collapses by 82. That was a really bad year for governments all around the world and the American government and for people and citizens. What happens? The solar government says, I think we have to come back in. These kids have run the gamut and screwed up. So the solar government offers its historical wealth, which, as I said, was not based on loans. We had a solid, we continue investing from 1930, 1980, doing good business decisions, investing in new technologies and that. So we said, we've got to bring in our gang. So what do? Call up the Queen Elizabeth, get Prince Charles to marry somebody, because nobody can relate on that corporate, in quotes, respectable world unless you got a wife in that proper Android meme clone situation, because that's a basic cultural meme. So not so much today. But back then, in 81, he marries Diana, and then Prince Charles, you see, becomes a world figure. You Americans didn't even know about him in the 70s.
True.
You know what I mean? All of a sudden, the media, Vanity Fair magazine, which brings over Tina Brown and her husband, Evans, British intelligence, the whole European guys come over, create Vanity Fair, and you have that wacky world in New York City and American culture where this European Eurotrash situation happens. That was thanks to me. I'm the one who introduced Lady Di to Prince Charles, in particular, you know, that situation. And that introduction required us going through the historical files of the oligarchies and saying, Charles, who do you think we should marry? Who's the best person for this role? And Lady Di was picked and never fully understood it. She was informed, but she's a young girl. She can't fully, she was like me in the 40s, didn't fully.